It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A NASA mission placed three small satellites into low Earth orbit Sunday. The mission, named VR3X, will test how the satellites might track and communicate with one another. The mission's principal investigator is Zach Manchester, an assistant professor in Carnegie Mellon University's Robotics Institute. Zach, welcome to the Confluence.
Hi, how you doing?
I am well, thank you. Zach, for several years, companies have been launching small satellites for various tasks. Is it getting a little crowded up there?
Yeah, I suppose. There's definitely more. There have been more launches in the last sort of few years than you know, the previous several decades combined. So it's activity in space has definitely been ramping up in say, the last decade in a pretty dramatic way.
So what exactly is a swarm of satellite, and what do you hope to do?
Right now, most missions are done by really kind of individual spacecraft that are individually tasked, commanded, and that sort of thing from the ground. And the swarm idea, in contrast, is this idea of having a whole bunch of satellites, maybe dozens or hundreds or even thousands, that are communicating with each other and have some degree of autonomy to process data on board, task themselves, and sort of act, at least to some extent, independently of ground operators, and not require this sort of constant sort of babysitting from the ground.
So are you saying that they would decide, they wouldn't need to rely on you, rely on NASA? They would actually, in a sense, make the decisions about, in your example?
Yeah, that's the goal, right? The goal is to sort of move in the direction of greater autonomy on these satellite swarms, so that rather than so right now we operate in what's traditionally called the bent pipe model. The idea here is the satellite's really just effectively a big camera or a big radio transmitter sitting in the sky, and you know, data comes up and down, and really everything's done on the ground. All of the image processing or analysis and decision making and planning about what to do next is all done on the ground. And we're trying to push towards a different paradigm where there's at least some or more of that kind of data analysis, data processing, and planning going on board the satellites themselves, so that there's not so much reliance on the ground. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. One is, you know, as you can imagine, scaling from like 10 or 20 satellites to 1,000 satellites is going to make sort of having to coordinate with the ground all the time much harder. And we kind of need to go towards more autonomy to be able to scale. And the other reason is that right now, with this so-called bent pipe model where we're just trying to get all that imagery down to the ground, there's two big problems with that. First off, there's a big bottleneck in trying to communicate that much data to the ground, and you're only flying over ground stations a few times a day. So inevitably, you're throwing out a lot of that image data. And right now, in fact, the majority of the imagery collected on board these imaging satellites is actually thrown out because it can't be downlinked. We can't get it all down to the ground.
Your graduate student, Max Holliday, built a lot of the satellite construction from his kitchen, I understand, due to the COVID-19 pandemic. What's it been like trying to plan a space mission from home?
This whole mission was done pretty much start to finish in a single year, from conception to launch. And, you know, while that's kind of okay over Zoom for some things, it's not great for trying to build spacecraft hardware. Eventually, we did, you know, take all this into the lab at NASA Ames, into a clean room to do the final assembly and testing. But yeah, a lot of the prototyping and initial debugging and building of circuit boards and all that happened in kitchens and living rooms and all kinds of stuff.
What does this ability, or what you hope will be the ability of swarming satellites, mean to the average person here down on Earth?
Most people don't really appreciate how much we actually rely on spacecraft in our everyday lives. It's actually surprisingly prevalent, and I pretty much guarantee you that all of us are relying in some way on something coming from space every day. The most prominent examples would be GPS, which is in not just your car navigation system or your phone to, you know, do Google Maps and things like that, but is actually behind timing for tons of public infrastructure like the power grid and bank transactions for getting precise time. You know, we've become more and more reliant on space over the past 20, 30 years to where it's really a part of our everyday lives, even if we don't really realize it every day.
Is there a timetable for this mission?
The nominal mission is for about the next year. The satellites themselves will probably stay in orbit a little bit longer than that, but probably by the 2 years from now, they'll be re-entered and burn up in the atmosphere.
So we've been talking about low-level orbit around Earth. Is there the potential for this concept to be used farther out into space? And if so, for what?
So, I mean, personally, as a huge space nerd and someone who's been, kind of interested in exploration my whole life, there are several applications for this kind of technology. One that's sort of still maybe in Earth orbit is building giant radio telescopes where, you can imagine we can build dishes only so large. And if you want something bigger than that, you can instead do something called a phased array where you try to kind of add together the signals from a whole bunch of antennas that are spread out over a big area and sort of form a virtual giant telescope. So that's one fun application for these sort of swarms of small satellites that we might sort of look forward to in the future, being able to build giant telescopes out in space to look way out into the cosmos.
Carnegie Mellon University robotics professor Zach Manchester is the principal investigator of a NASA mission to test how satellites can work together and autonomously. Zach, thanks so much for your time and good luck with the mission.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Spanish flu pandemic of 1918, two world wars, the Great Depression, other recessions couldn't stop it, but apparently the coronavirus pandemic has. Carlisle's Bridal of Pittsburgh, believed to be the oldest bridal shop in the nation, is closing its doors next month. Jan Winters, a fifth-generation manager of Carlisle's. Jan, welcome back to The Confluence.
Thank you for having me.
Jan, back in May, you spoke with my then-colleague and co-host, Megan Harris, as you were getting ready to reopen following a lifting of the shutdown orders. Were the safety protocols that were put into place too limiting for your business, or did potential clients just not come back? No proms, weddings placed on hold? What was it?
It was a little of everything. We could only have a maximum of 11 people in the store at one time. So we had to limit the number of people that the bride could even bring with her to help choose a dress. Their weddings have been postponed. Most of them now are even postponed till 22, just because people don't even know in 21 if they'll be able to have a wedding.
Jan, did the limitations cause you to miss on providing gowns for any weddings?
We only had to give money back to one customer. It was a mother. They had postponed the wedding, but we still wouldn't have made it had they had the wedding. So that was the only wedding I would have missed. We came close on a couple within a couple weeks, but we were able to deliver everything that way.
Came close. Did you have some nervous brides and maybe moms as well because you came close?
Yes, we did. I was on the phone a lot, just calming everyone. I'm on top of it.
Were you able to get the gowns you needed? Because you've said in the past, a majority of them are actually produced in China, I believe.
Yes. And then a lot of the beading is done in India. China was up and rolling again for manufacturing, but India came after us having the coronavirus bad and had to shut down. It has been an entire year of ups and downs with the coronavirus throughout the whole industry.
Carlisle's has survived many storms over 132 years. You told my then-colleague Megan Harris that your great-grandmother pawned jewelry in China to keep the shop open during the Great Depression. Was it a matter you couldn't really hang on till a return to normalcy or what?
I had asked the landlord for a reduction in rent because I can't do business like I used to do. And instead of reducing the rent, he said he would move me to a smaller space, which I really can't do. I need every bit of what I have.
Yours is a different experience than other businesses because the process of selecting and fitting a bridal gown, it's an intimate one, a longer one. Do you get to be friends with your clients?
Yes, yes. And we get to know, we ask them what they do for their jobs and what does their fiance do? And we ask when we see the ring, did they help pick it out or did the fiance do it themselves? I mean, because normally we're with them for almost a year because they order and then it takes months for the dresses to come in and then alterations takes 3 months. So we get to know the brides and their mother and a sister pretty well.
I would imagine that you and your family have had brides and then later on maybe their daughters as brides coming to your shop.
We're on granddaughters. even just this last weekend, we had the mother, her mother, and we just sold the granddaughter. So we're on third generation brides.
That must make you smile when somebody comes back with their daughter and now with a granddaughter.
It's such a gratifying business because you have to remember there's really two really, I would say, significant, important events that happen to women. And one is getting married, their wedding day, and another is having children. And I get to help them with one of those. And so, yeah, it's very special.
So, Jan, you're closing the doors on the shop at the end of February, but are you still getting customers? I mean, we've talked about how extensive of a process the selection and the fitting is.
We are so busy from customers wanting to be Carlisle Bride. Customers don't even have wedding dates set for 2022, but they want to come in and get a dress. They know they're getting a deal because I'm selling my samples at 50% off, but they also want to be a Carlisle bride. So it is so heartwarming. Just the people coming in and just their kind words. And I get phone calls from people. It's been lovely.
Jan, what's the store, closing the store, mean to you? What are you feeling right now?
For me, it first, when I had to call all the customers to let them know, before we even put it out there, that's what I did. I called every customer. I broke down several times just calling and telling them. Now I'm so busy, it keeps my mind off of it. I'm sure towards the end, it'll be very hard again, though.
Jan Winner is a fifth-generation manager of the oldest bridal shop in the nation, Carlisle's of Pittsburgh, which is closing next month. Thanks, Jan. Congratulations on all you've done.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Johnstown is the setting for a new nonfiction book titled Small Time, a story of my family and the mob. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll spoke with author Russell Shorto outdoors in Johnstown's Central Park.
This is a book about Johnstown in a lot of ways.
Yep.
So how would you describe it to somebody who didn't know anything about it, never been here before?
I always tell people Johnstown's a great place to be from. It had its heyday. It's a kind of a classic Rust Belt town in western Pennsylvania.
And it's also, it's a family story.
I think the idea that my grandfather was involved in the mob is something that I always knew, but there was a little bit of a family veil of silence, kind of an unofficial thing. You just didn't talk about it. And then a few years ago, an elderly relative who was out of town for his whole adult life came back over the holidays and he said to me, "Hey, you're a writer. What are you going to do about the story?" And I realized I write history for a living. This is maybe a pretty cool history. And there weren't enough old guys still around that I could get a bit of a firsthand and a sense and mix that together with archival stuff, FBI Freedom of Information Act stuff, and put it all together. And it's about my grandfather and my grandmother. But it's also about this thing that people don't know much about, which is the small town mob, which was everywhere.
your sources were people who were sort of members of your extended family in a way, socially, right? These were people that your father knew, your grandfather worked with and knew in the 50s and 60s, right?
Right.
And even before.
And everybody in town, everybody I talked to over the age of like 75, knew them, was on a first name basis with them. They knew kind of how the operation worked. We're right around the corner. We're in Central Park now. We're right around the corner from the pool hall that was the base of their operation. It was called City Cigar, and it was two doors from City Hall. And they would, you know, pay off the cops, and periodically the cops would say, okay, we're going to come and we have to raid once a month to, you know, and so they'd leave some slips around and things like that. It was all in the open.
And why Italians? You talk about this in the book a little bit. Why would it have been that particular ethnic new immigrant group that went into an enterprise like this?
You know, I'm so aware of it now with the debates about immigration now and what immigrants are doing. So they were allowed in vast numbers to do this kind of work that nobody else wanted to do. But then they were excluded from most of the rest of society. And I heard stories about this once I opened people up in my own family about how they weren't allowed to open bank accounts. Initially, they weren't allowed to work in the steel mills even. These guys admired American capitalism. And they admired the titans of capitalism, you know, Astor and Carnegie and those guys. And they also admired the fact that they seemed to get away with murder. You know, they could do whatever they wanted. So they kind of created their own system within that. I talked about banks, for example. Here in town, my grandfather and his brother-in-law, they created a numbers game that they called the GI Bank. GI because it was like right after World War II, and I think they thought, oh, this is like patriotic or something. And bank meaning people thought of as, you don't realize it, but people thought when they're playing the numbers, it was an investment.
The book is to a large degree about these familial relationships, especially with your father, because he helped you do a lot of the research, right?
Yeah, the great thing about the book was that my dad was willing to do this with me. And my dad lived in Johnstown all his life. He grew up admiring his father, but being kind of pushed aside by his father. So he had this real chip on his shoulder. And then he was willing to do this with me, to take me around town to open doors. I mean, my dad knew the chief of police, who gave me access to the town records, you know. And there I saw, you know, arrests of my grandfather and all that kind of thing. I think in a way it was a little bit like therapy for my dad, too. And unfortunately, he died just as I was kind of finishing the research part of it. So it was, you know, for someone of my age, it was particularly meaningful because that was the most time I'd spent with my father since I was a kid. And it was right at the end of his life and as we were trying to understand his relationship with his father.
That was author Russell Shorto talking with WESA's Bill O'Driscoll about his new book, Small Time, A Story of My Family and the Mob. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.